Welcome for Computer Graphics. Today we will look into scene graphs and also do a little bit of modeling. So essentially the idea is that up to now we were always looking at the lower part or later part of the rendering pipeline. That is, we were looking at how can we rasterize single triangles, how can we transform these, how can we do a shading on these triangles, how can we apply textures. But we didn't really look at the top above that. Yeah. So where do the triangles come from? How is this entire scene content, how is that generated? And this is what we will look at today. So you see, if we I already mentioned a few times that we can organize the entire rendering process in a pipeline that has various stages. Yeah, and we were always looking at these stages now. And in the beginning, there's a 3D scene. Yeah, that is then transformed somehow into triangles. And from the triangles on, we know how to handle them. Today we will look at this stage here. And this stage is a little bit at the interface between CPU and GPU. Normally in the beginning, we have a scene that is stored on the CPU. We know the objects in our scene, maybe how they are moving and all that stuff. And then at some point, we have to transfer the data to the GPU and then do the rendering on the GPU. We will now look at this interface here. Yeah, where does the 3D scene, how is that modeled, and how is it handled, and how do we get the data prepared for rendering? Yeah, and for this we need a number of scene objects. And if you remember the last lectures, for instance, in the beginning we were looking at very simple objects like cubes, or single triangles, even only. And of course, that's the normal way to start with. Yeah, so we have very simple objects, such as spheres, cones, cylinders that can be described very easily, and for which it's also rather simple to transform them to a triangle mesh or similar. Yeah, so for a cube, we can simply enumerate the vertices and enumerate how the triangles finally form the cube. And the same is true for spheres, cones, and cylinders, and so on. But that would not be a sufficient basis to make a movie, for instance, or a computer game. So in these scenarios, we need real modeling tools, programs that allow us to generate nicely looking characters that in the end are only triangles, but at the beginning, of course, they are not triangles, more than triangles. No movie is created by starting with 1 million triangles, and then an artist takes the single vertices of the triangles and moves them to the right position. That's not the way how it works. And this is what we will look into a little bit. Yeah, how can we model such nice looking shapes and then convert them to triangles. Another possibility is to use scanned objects. That means take real-world objects and then run any method to capture that 3D shape of the object. So for instance, that bunny that we've also used in several of the demos and that you've probably seen quite often already now is a real-world object that has been scanned there are a number of methods available to do that. And then this gives a rather fine triangle mesh, and this we can also use for rendering. It's a little bit a variant of these objects designed by a modeling tool. Another alternative is to take so-called freeform surfaces. These are surfaces that are not only triangles, but they are described in a mathematical way with mathematical formulas. Then find a subdivided, and I just see the C next week. Please skip that, that's wrong. Because I will a little bit go into details for that already today. Okay, so these are a few variants, where these objects come from. And so probably if you start with computer graphics, the typical way to get objects from is that you just look in the internet, and search for objects that you think that are nice. There are many people provide their 3D models that they somehow generated. And then they are usually provided in some data format that then needs to be parsed before you can use these objects. And one format that you've maybe already seen in the exercises, I'm not quite sure about, or maybe you just didn't realize that it's this file format, is very widely used, just as an example, because it's very simple. And it's called OBJ, that stands for object. And here is an example for an OBJ file. And it's really very, very simple. Every line starts with an identifier, what that line will provide now. For instance, V stands for vertex. And then after the V come three coordinates, X, Y, and Z coordinate of that vertex. And you see here we have a scene that has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 vertices. Yeah, it could be that it's a cube. Next here come lines with VN, that stands for vertex normals. Yeah, so these are normal vectors. And here we have six normals, six different normals, eight vertices. Yeah, I think it's really a cube. And then we have finally single faces. Yeah, that's lines starting with an F. And here, this face now has four vertices, so it's a quadrilateral. And each vertex now is in the form vertex number / texture coordinate number / normal number. So that means the first vertex takes the first corner of that face has as coordinates the first vertex, so it has these coordinates. The normal is also the first one, so it's that normal, and it has no texture coordinate. Yeah, that's how you can read that. So these three together form one corner of the face, and the next corner has the 3D position of vertex 2, but it has the same normal. The normal is also 1, because the side faces of a cube, they all have the same normals. So you see, it's the index buffer, so to say, for the vertices and for the normals in that format is different. I mean, that's a decision from them. Others don't separate these. So if you have two vertices with different normals, these are two separate vertices. Okay. I mean, it's a design decision. And it's also not that important. Yeah, it's just that you see how such a format can look like. That one is very, very simple. It doesn't have, at least as we see here, there are not things like materials, textures, and so on. Yeah, that's all missing. And for real-world large modeling systems, there are much more complicated files that are much more complicated to parse. Okay, so just an example. Yeah, this is how we can get objects. Yeah, but we've already seen stuff like that, and you know how we handle these. We take all the vertex data and write it to a large array. We take an index buffer that tells us that's the topology, how these vertices are to be connected to triangles. Then we create buffers to store this data. That means to upload that data to GPU. Yeah, so we read the file, then all the data is on the CPU. We upload it to the GPU. We do that for the vertex data and for the index buffer. And then to render that, we only need one single call. Yeah, that's this draw elements call. And with that draw call, then the GPU can can start and render all these long triangle lists. Yeah? And while the GPU renders on the CPU, we can do other stuff that's done asynchronously. And yeah, so we upload all that data ideally once in the beginning, and then when we render our scene and we want to re-render, we have a dynamic scene where things are moving, then we re-render every frame. And we don't always, for every frame, have to upload data, but only call this draw elements and maybe reset some matrices so things move a little bit and things happen. Okay, now another way to get triangle meshes, I already said so, is to have simple shapes. For instance, like spheres for a cube. It's rather simple, really, just to enumerate the vertices. For a sphere, it's maybe a little bit more complicated. And in particular, for a sphere, I mean, we can only approximate it by triangles. And obviously, we have to decide how well we want to approximate it, yeah, how many triangles we want to spend to represent that sphere. So if we take many small triangles, we have a wonderful smooth sphere, but we also have many triangles, which makes things maybe slow. So essentially what we will need is something like a procedure, yeah, that subdivides such a sphere into a set of triangles, and then we can decide how fine do we want to do that. And maybe for some spheres it's less important, and for other spheres we really want to have them finely subdivided. And so here we can see how that, for instance, for a sphere would work. Yeah, we have here something that we call triangle strips. So it's strips of triangles, and then we subdivide the sphere into such, but slabs, and generate triangle strips from north to south, and by varying the increments of the angles, we can vary the fineness of the subdivision. Yeah, so this process is called tessellation. That means we have some description of our surface, and now we subdivide it into small triangles. Yeah. That means we tessellate that object. We generate triangles that approximate that surface. And we will come back to tessellation during the lecture. Okay, and of course the same works for cylinders, for cones, for tori, and whatever. Yeah? And if we want to be a little bit more flexible with our shapes, what we can do are so-called free-form surfaces. And to be honest, I'm not sure whether this is still a topic in Algorithmen kontinuierliche Systeme. People are nodding. Okay, so you know Bézier curves, at least those who attended that lecture. So here the idea is that we can define nice mathematical polynomial curves with what we call control points. So the idea is that we want to have a smooth curve, and what we define is a kind of coarse version of that curve, and then these points are used to describe or to derive a mathematical description of a smooth curve that sort of approximates this coarse control polygon. Yeah, we call it control polygon. And in fact, also the teapot that you've very likely seen already, if you're in any Pixar movie, I think it's really in any, at some point this teapot appears somewhere. Yeah, this teapot is one of the first models in computer graphics that has been defined using these Bézier surfaces. And in fact, this is from a computer graphics museum, a drawing, the original drawing, where I think it was Jim Blin even modeled a teapot that was on his desk, and he wanted to have a computer model, so he did that drawing. And here you can see these control curves, and the shape that results from that. So hints, for instance, here for the handle, you can see that the control polygon is pretty coarse, Yeah, or here has a very very spiky, but the shape that is generated by that is very smooth. And in fact, the original teapot that was on his desk is 40% or is less high than the original, and he scaled it by 1.4 because the pixels on his device were not square but rectangular. But the original teapot is still used, yeah? So that model that is always used is just 40% too tall. Okay, yeah, so that's the idea. Of course, you can also do that. Take a piece of paper, yeah, draw some control points and get this nice shape here. And yeah, just to give you a brief impression how that works, we have a lecture, geometric modeling, where you can learn all the details about the math of these curves. But just to give you a short impression, because it's really very often used if we do modeling, that we take such curves here to generate nice objects. Here's the most simple model of a very simple version of a Bézier curve, defined by four control points. Yeah, and these four control points define what we call a control polygon, and then this curve approximates this control polygon, as you probably know, and there are some simple properties. So for instance, the starting point and the end point are always interpolated, and the first edge of the control polygon, the curve is tangential to, and also at the arrival point, it's tangential to the last edge of that control polygon, and that's already pretty intuitive. To define curves. So as a simple example, yeah, here we have that set up again, and now we can move single control points, and it's rather simple to predict how the resulting curve will look like. Yeah, so if we want to get a special shape, then we can easily get that, yeah, just by moving these control points. It's pretty intuitive. I think Bézier was an engineer with Renault, so he was, yeah, sort of invented these curves or defined these curves to model cars, yeah? And later on then it was quickly found out, yeah, what the math behind all that is. And essentially the math behind that is that it's a polynomial curve. That means it's a curve that can be described with polynomials. It's a polynomial by, in the following form, we have points in 3D space or in 2D space, if it's a 2D curve, the points along the curve can be described as functions of a parameter u, and u is just a value that is for zero, you get the starting point of the curve, and for u equals 1, we get the endpoint of the curve. Yeah, and for values in between, this point sweeps along that curve. And this function can be described as a polynomial in u. Yeah, something like this, and so forth. Yeah, so every component x, y, and z is a polynomial in u. And in particular, these Bézier curves can be described as a linear combination of the control points. So if we have the control points, Ci, these are the four control points you've seen before, yeah, these red dots that we can move around. And now every point on the curve is a linear combination of these points, and the how they are combined is controlled by these functions here, yeah? And these are the so-called Bernstein polynomials. You can see them up here. And here we can see plots of these curves. And what we can see here is that, for instance, this blue curve is responsible for the first control point. And you see in the beginning it's 1, and all the others are 0. So this is the parameter u, by the way. So this is the beginning of the curve. This is the end. And in the beginning, only the first control point gets weight 1 and the others get 0. This is why the starting control point is interpolated. Yeah, that's here. For u equals 0, we get this control point, and then the weight for this point decreases and for that one increases. That's the red curve. Yeah. Now it more and more goes towards the first point until that one decreases again, and the third point becomes more and more important. And in the end, it's the last control point that gains importance and has a weight of 1, and the others have 0. Yeah? And so it's a rather simple mathematical concept. Most often, Bézier curves of degree 3 are used. That means we have 4 control points and a cubic curve. But there are also Bézier curves of degree 2. Then we only have such a simple control polygon, which a parabola is fit into. But you can also define higher orders. Yeah, but cubic is most often used. Okay, so these are curves, just as a little remark. But we will come back to, or we will go to surfaces in a minute. Yeah, that's all the math is defined for the curves, and then we will simply go to surfaces. Okay, but now if we want to model something more complicated, yeah, like for instance that teapot, yeah, so these curves are more complicated. It's not only one curve, yeah, but so for instance the handle, yeah, has, or the entire lid, yeah, has some curve like this, yeah. To do that, what usually is done is that multiple Bézier curves are concatenated, so to say. Yeah? So we describe this curve as a piecewise Bézier curve. Yeah? So we could say that part is a Bézier curve, that one is one, and this is one. Yeah? So we have 3 Bézier curves that are glued together. So we can simply join these and... So here is an example. Nope, I should have. That's a little bit too many things mix here a little bit. So what we see here is the control polygon. So we have this Bézier polygon and this polygon, and you see the red curve and the green curve. Yeah, and now these curves are joined. That means that this control point is used for both curves. Yeah, which is obvious. Yeah, we want to have a closed curve. But obviously that's not really enough, because if I do something like this here in this point, I don't have a smooth curve anymore. Yeah, but something like an edge. But you know that the Bézier curve is tangential to this control polygon. So what we have to do is that we move also this control point, yeah, so that here we have a straight line. Not yet. And then the curve is sort of smooth again. But in fact, it's not very smooth, because it's only the direction is continuous at that point, but not the curvature. The direction is the first derivative and curvature is the second derivative. So we could also say we can make that even smoother if we also demand that the second derivative is the same. And this is now something that you see here in these two other plots here that are a little bit in the way here. So this is the first derivative. It's sort of the direction if we go along that curve. Yeah? So in the beginning, we go upwards. So that's this point. And in the end, we go a little bit to the lower right. That's this point. So this is the direction along the curve. And you see, I didn't do a very good job. So now here, at least the directions are smooth. Here along this curve, we go here. And then we rapidly... continue in this direction, so the directions are continuous, yeah, but obviously the curvature is not, because now here in the directional space. Yeah, it's not smooth. Yeah? Okay, good. So, but you see, if we want to model something like this, things become a little bit complicated, yeah? Because if I move that point, I also have to move that point. And in fact, even then I could look here. Now it's closed again. No, not really. Yeah, but this is not very intuitive, but we can define rules about the control points and enforce, for instance, that if I move that control point, then the other control point automatically moves so that here it is continuous. And in fact, we can even enforce that for the second derivative. By the way, these straight lines here are the second derivative. They are linear because we have a cubic curve. So if we even enforce that, then we have this set up here. And now whenever I move one control point, several other control points also are automatically moved so that this continuity is always maintained. Yeah, and now we have wonderful smooth curves, but you see it's sometimes surprising what happens, to keep all that consistent, in our curves. So that works, but to have smooth joints can become a little bit difficult. So the next step is kind of to enforce that constraint, these constraints, and the result are so-called B-splines. That's essentially what I've just shown you, but we have much less control points again, and we can now again freely move all these control points. And the curve we get in the end is again piecewise polynomial, but it's automatically guaranteed that these piecewise polynomial curves are always have a very smooth transition, so we don't really see these joints anymore. Yeah, and so we can generate arbitrary long curves with a set of control points. Yeah, we cannot only take four control points, but we can take arbitrarily many and get a very nice smooth curve in between. It's piecewise, it's a cubic curve typically, but we don't have to look at the joints. Yeah, it's automatically by construction always very smooth. And now these basis functions, it's exactly the same idea like here. We have a set of basis functions that together are weights for our control points, but now the basis functions look more like this. So you see along the curve, every control point has kind of maximum importance. It rises, and then we have some maximum importance, and then the importance goes down again. And when this goes down, the next control point becomes more important, and so forth. And these basis functions here are also rather simple to construct. We can see here how this looks like, and the result. Result we can see here. Probably that you can see the yellow. Now here we have a control polygon, and you see this curve here. The different colors are different curve segments. So these are all Bézier curves, as you've seen before, or they could also be described by Bézier curves. But now we can arbitrarily move all the points, and you see at the joints that it's always there's always automatically a smooth transition. And now this is quadratic, but we could also go for now that's cubic. The curve looks like this. Down here you can see the basis functions. And this now allows us to model arbitrary long curves. There are many more free degrees of freedom now. So for instance, we can change the importance of the different segments. And it is also possible to assign weights to the single point. So for instance, if we increase the weight for that point, then the curve is more pulled towards that point and so on. Yeah, to have a more intuitive way to handle these curves. Now these are variants, yeah, some are called non-uniform B-splines, yeah, that's when we change the lengths of these segments, or rational B-splines that have weights for the single curves, and if we apply all these extensions, we get something that is called NURBS, non-uniform rational B-splines, and in fact NURBS are the free form rendering primitive, yeah? Probably every car that you see around today originally have been NURBS, yeah, non-uniform rational B-splines, or have been modeled as such by designers. Yeah, so in car industry, that's the best or understood modeling primitive to model nice smooth surfaces. So yeah, that was just a very brief glimpse into that. If you find such stuff interesting and the math behind that, our lecture Geometric Modeling really looks into the details of that stuff and how all that works and what we can derive for these. Okay, and here an example. Some of you maybe know the modeling tool Blender, which is a very powerful modeling tool that allows you to model such scenes, and even it also has renderer included. Very powerful. Complete movies already have been made with Blender. It's free. So it's definitely worth to have a look at that. Yeah, and one of the basic primitives also in Blender are these NURBS surfaces. So here we can see such an example, and now we already see the 2D equivalent. I will explain how that works, so the order is not very well chosen. So this is the 2D equivalent. Now here we don't have a control polygon, yeah, but we have a real control mesh, is spawned by these control points, and then the surface approximates this mesh. Yeah, so you see this mesh here in orange, and then this is the surface that is generated by that mesh. And now we can take single control points and move these. Yeah, and here, for instance, now we can see after moving that this corresponding surface is deformed accordingly, yeah, and we can model nice organic shapes. In fact, I wanted to show that in Blender, and I even have it open here, but I forgot my mouse, and Blender without a middle button, which I don't have here on my trackpad, is impossible to use, at least for me. So please excuse. Here we have images that show how that works. Okay, good. So, I said that these NURBS surfaces are a de facto standard when cars are designed. So in automotive industry, they are the standard. But in fact, if you go to the movies, yeah, and you see a character there, then another variant will be used. And these are so-called subdivision surfaces. And here the idea is the following. If we look at B-splines again, yeah, and we say, okay, I have a control polygon, and this control polygon defines my B-spline surface. Now, a simple way to tessellate that, yeah, to generate triangles, or in that case now line segments that approximate the original curve or the curve that we want, is to use so-called subdivision. And for B-splines, a very simple, the rule is very simple. We take every segment of our control polygon and then put new points at 1/4 of the segment and at 3/4. So this is at 1/4, 3/4, 1/4, 3/4. Yeah. And then we cut off the edges. This is why the algorithm, the corners, this is why this algorithm is called corner cutting. So from here, we go to that curve. Yeah. So we cut off the edges of our control polygon, and now we get something a little bit rounder. And of course, for that polygon, we can do exactly the same again and can cut off the corners. And if you do that a few times, we get we get always longer and longer control polygon, but it converges to the final curve. And because we are not really interested in the final mathematical description, but only, yeah, in a tessellation, yeah, only in an approximation of that curve, this is, from a computer graphics perspective, the simplest way. Yeah, so instead of deriving something mathematical from that control polygon, we just do that corner cutting algorithm a few times until it is so finely subdivided, yeah, that we are fine. And we say this is our result. Okay, that's the fastest approach to generate an approximate line curve, yeah, that or a polyline that represents our final curve. And in fact, we can also do that. And now finally, I come to 2D. We can also do that, all transfer these ideas to 2D. So first of all, B-splines can simply be transferred to 2D in the following way. We say, okay, now instead of a control line, we have such a control mesh. The points in this control mesh are ordered on a regular grid, like we see here. Yeah, so here we have a simple grid instead of our parameter space for the curve that goes from 0 to 1. Now we have a 2D grid that spans that surface. Yeah, and on each of these grid points, for each of these grid points, we have one control point. And yeah, now we simply apply these curve rules. So what we do is that, first of all, we always take three control points, or always one column in this mesh. So three control points here, and then fit or approximate these with a curve. Yeah. And to evaluate at an arbitrary position, yeah, we evaluate these curves at the corresponding parameter in this direction, and then fit a new curve through these, and evaluate that curve at the other parameter v, and this gives us that point. Yeah, so we simply apply these curve rules for all columns, and then this gives control points for a row, and we get that point. Of course, we can also do it the other way around, apply it to the columns, to the rows, and then do it column-wise, and we would get the same point. Yeah, it's a very simple extension. It's the so-called tensor product approach to go come from curves to 3D surfaces. And yeah, so this is the result here. Yeah, so we have our coarse polygon, and here then we have our nice, fine, smooth, subdivided or mesh. And of course, now, so this tells us how we can evaluate at an arbitrary point, uv. But of course, now we can also apply the subdivision idea from before. What we can also do is that we take these single points and subdivide them in this direction. And yeah, then we get a finer mesh. We get additional control points here. And we can do a subdivision in this direction. Yeah, and then we also subdivide the mesh in the horizontal direction. Yeah, we just apply these rules, this corner cutting, Yeah, which by the way, yeah, for NURBS, this becomes more complicated. For simple B-splines, this rule is fine, yeah, but otherwise the positions where we have to do that corner cutting are more complicated. But we can apply exactly the same also on such meshes here, on such coarse meshes. And here we can see a result, yeah? So that's a coarse mesh, yeah, somehow generated. And if we subdivide that mesh, yeah, we come to here and to here. And you can imagine if we do that maybe once or twice more, yeah, then we will have something very smooth. And this is only what we have to model. Yeah, this is our input and this is the result. Yeah, and so we can describe nice organic surfaces like faces, for instance, or bodies or whatever, bananas, apples, yeah, you name it. And yeah, it's sort of practical, yeah, because the modeler only has to work on this mesh and then automatically what is rendered in the end is this smooth version here. Okay, so that's always the, or very often the idea. We only have a coarse mesh that only gives the coarse structure, the coarse shape of what we want to have. And then we say, okay, smooth it. Yeah, and then some algorithm, typically such a subdivision step here, generates something round and organic. And essentially, the user can decide how fine do we have to subdivide until we are fine. But modeling is only done on the very coarse level. And this is called subdivision surfaces. Yeah, if you look into Blender, you will also find these. But the problem for now is that here we always assume, as I described it here, that we have such a regular mesh of control points. Yeah, we always have such a regular mesh so that we can do this row and column wise. But if you only imagine that you have a cube, for instance, yeah, these four faces of a cube, they have a different topology. Yeah, how they are connected is very different. Yeah, or is different from that here. Because here, every vertex has four neighbors. Yeah, so this vertex has four neighbors, this one. And I mean, if we would make it larger, this is on the boundary, so that doesn't count. But if we would make it larger, yeah, then every neighbor has four vertices. But if you look at the corner of a cube, yeah, every vertex only has three neighbors. Yeah, so if you want to apply these rules here, yeah, so what is a row in this cube, yeah, and what is a column? You cannot really define that. And so essentially now the idea of subdivision surfaces is to extend that idea that we've seen before and that only works on such regular topology, yeah, and to extend that to arbitrary meshes so that it can also be applied, for instance, here for a cube, yeah, and do subdivisions to a cube, and in the end, convert that cube ideally to something very round like a sphere. And yeah, these are then real subdivision surfaces. That's an idea that comes from film industry, and the probably, yeah, first and still most often used subdivision scheme is so-called Catmull-Clark surfaces. Ed Catmull, by the way, is the boss of Pixar, I think still, and thus of Disney, yeah. he also defined that subdivision scheme, and the idea is very simple. So let's say we have an arbitrary surface defined with quads. That's one limitation of that method. It doesn't work with triangle meshes, but with quad meshes. Yeah. So we take something modeled from quads, for instance, a cube, or it can be something more complicated. Yeah, but it's a very coarse mesh defined from quads. And now for each of these quads, generate the center point. That's very simple. Yeah, we just take the four corner points of a quad and average them, and then we get a so-called face point. Yeah, it's a point on the face. So in that example, it's again a regular structure, but it would exactly work that way here on the cube. On the cube, we just generate the center points on all the faces. Yeah, so that's step number one, face points. Then we generate points on all of the edges. Just by averaging the two face points. Yeah, so every edge connects two faces. So we take the two corresponding face points and the start and end point of that edge. Yeah, these four points are averaged, and this gives us an edge point. So in that example on the cube, yeah, so for this edge, we average this point, and this point. So we get a point which is not really on the edge, but a little bit inside. Yeah, because these two, yeah, pull it a little bit to the inside. Yeah, and the same here, and here, and here, and here, and here. And then we move the original points of our face. Yeah, and we move them to the average of the edge points of the surrounding edges and the face points of the surrounding faces. Yeah, and that means in the final step, we move these points, these corner points, to the average of these. I cannot draw it very well. That one. The three face points and the three edge points. Here would be another one. Yeah, so we pull that one to the inside again. Yeah, so we're always averaging around our neighborhood, and that makes things smoother and smoother and smoother. And these rules do not only work for such a regular grid, but they also work here for an arbitrary grid of quads. And so here we can see an example. Yeah. For instance, here that that shape here, Volkswagen Beetle, we can now apply such a subdivision step. Yeah, so imagine for each of these vertices here, yeah, we apply exactly these rules that we've seen before, yeah, and as a result, we get smaller faces, finer faces. Yeah, as we can. I should have mentioned that. Yeah, so these points are again now, of course, connected to quads. Yeah, so this large quad is subdivided into four smaller quads now. Yeah, so a large quad becomes four smaller quads, and the vertices end up at these average positions. Yeah, and so our model becomes finer and finer, and in the end, yeah, we get something that is very smooth, that looks very much like a car. But this is the input, yeah? This is what has been modeled. And that does not only work for cars, but also for faces. So for instance, that's a very, at least in our community, a very famous movie, Gary's Game. It's a short movie of Pixar. They always make such short movies where they introduce new technologies. Do we have a technical problem? Okay. Good, so short break. so they make short movies to introduce or to test new techniques. And yeah, this is sort of the short movie that introduced subdivision surfaces. And here you can see the main character, Gary. And this is the mesh, yeah, that has been used, and that probably here already at least one subdivision has been applied. Yeah, so it's a coarse mesh that generates this entire face here. Yeah, and with subdivision, then this can easily be made a very, very round shape. And there's also another effect. Maybe you can imagine that it is rather simple now to animate, of course, that character is animated and the head is moving and speaking and so on. And now you can animate only that coarse version of the head, yeah, and then always do the subdivision after animation. Yeah, and this makes also animation much simpler, yeah, because you only have to take care of that coarse mesh and animate that one, and then by the subdivision, something nice, smooth looking comes out again in the end. Okay, good. Yeah, and in the end, of course, after subdivision, we get very fine quad meshes, so meshes of quadrilaterals, and yeah, just to render them with OpenGL, we subdivide every quad into two triangles and give them to the pipeline, yeah, and let them render. So our input, very coarse quad mesh, output, a fine triangle mesh that can be rendered. Yeah, that's sort of how such modeling stuff works, or how the input triangle meshes are generated. So here again, an example from Blender. Sorry that I, yeah, prefer not to show it here live, but in Blender, for instance, we can, there's one of these, or this monkey model is a kind of model that you can create by one click, and which is the basis for experiments if you want to play around. This is how this monkey model looks like. Yeah, if you immediately load it, we see several faces, all quad faces here, by the way, or not all. Okay, but yeah, faces, very coarse. I would even say it doesn't look like a monkey, but it's named monkey. It more looks like a whatever alien or so. Yeah, but very, very coarse faces. And now we can apply subdivision to that in Blender, essentially by one click. And this is what we get after two subdivision steps only, yeah, from here to here. It's only two subdivision steps, so it's much, much rounder. But we can still see the single facets, but only because it's using flat shading. So if we switch to smooth shading, we get this here. Yeah? And that was the input. Yeah? And this is the rendering result. So in that case, probably two subdivisions are already enough. And of course, that means we also need normals and so forth, yeah, shading normals and Phong shading and all this, these techniques that you've learned before. But it's rather simple to generate nice looking, interesting input using these very simple techniques. And of course, yeah, the same works for these NURB surfaces. Yeah, so we model something very coarsely, and then we say subdivide up to a certain level that is fine for us, and then we get very, very many polygons, very many small triangles that describe a nice smooth shape, but we only had to model the control points. Yeah, and here sort of the control points are this here, the coarse input mesh. Okay, good. Now, yeah, just to sum up that part, so what we typically do is that we store a coarse model only, yeah, coarse geometry, and then, yeah, okay, now here I already used the name scene graph, I will introduce it then again in a minute. Then we have a sort of framework, yeah, that takes this coarse model, and then applies a subdivision, like we learned it here, and then the triangles are used for rendering. But in fact, if we want to do that in a computer games context, for instance, now we have a problem that I've already described before for GPU rendering. What we want to avoid is that we upload geometry from the CPU to the GPU, yeah, because this is a rather expensive operation. So that's why I told you first upload all stuff to the GPU, to GPU memory, and then let the GPU do all the stuff. And that means ideally the GPU should be able to do the subdivision so that we only upload the coarse mesh Yeah, and then the GPU makes these subdivisions. And in fact, modern GPUs can do that. They support stuff like subdivision. So we can only upload coarse geometry, and then this geometry is subdivided or tessellated, and the vertices are moved to the right position. This is supported by late GPUs. This requires new shaders, so not only a vertex shader and a fragment shader, but we have stuff like, for instance, a geometry shader that can not only move vertices or shade pixels, but even generate triangles, or tessellation shaders, or mesh shaders. Yeah, this is all that stuff that is used for these steps. If you're interested in that, visit our lecture, Interactive Computer Graphics. There we will speak about all these different variants of shader with which we can also generate geometry on a GPU. Yeah. But for now, the important thing is that you understand how this works, and that we only work on the coarse model, and then fine triangle meshes come out. Okay, and now I said this is done by a framework, yeah? And usually this framework in computer graphics is called a scene graph. And the term scene graph, I've already used that or introduced that in the, I think, even very first lecture or in the second lecture, and this is the corresponding slide. And maybe you remember that, so that was in the context of 2D graphics, SVG, yeah? And there we introduced, also saw, that our models, our objects, our primitive circles and rectangles and what we had are usually organized hierarchically, and that in inner nodes we, for instance, could change the color of objects. So we had group nodes, yeah, that group multiple objects, and by setting the filling attribute to green, all objects underneath or within that groups automatically become green. And we also saw that this hierarchy doesn't need to be a tree, but it is possible that certain objects are referenced multiple times, yeah, so that it's like a tree where branches grow together again, and we call that a directed acyclic graph, yeah. And this is the normal way, or a typical way, how such scenes are modeled. We will come back to that now again. For 3D scenes, yeah, but that was the first introduction of that term scene graph, yeah, and okay, and essentially this idea, yeah, of a graph that models our scene is also used in 3D graphics and essentially in all modeling and render engines and so on, and so often scene graph is not only used for the data structure itself, but for the entire framework, yeah, that stores such a scene graph and that can do things on such a scene graph. But let's first of all look at a data structure scene graph. Yeah. So the typical way, if we have a larger scene that we want to model, is that we build a hierarchy on that scene. Yeah, so we model objects in groups. Yeah, and a very simple example would be a Mensa scene. Yeah, so let's say if you want to model our Mensa here, then probably you would start with the walls and with the floor and with the ceiling first of all. Yeah, so the entire surrounding, and if it comes to the interior, yeah, probably you would have a lot to do if you say, okay, now I model one chair, yeah, so it's the same chair, whatever, 900 times or something like that, and then we have also the same table 100 times, yeah, and you position all of these separately. That would be a lot of work, but the alternative would be the following, that you say, okay, there's always one table and eight chairs. Yeah, they are always relative to each other at the same position. So what we could do is that we take one table and position four chairs, yeah, and then we group all this, and then we say, okay, yeah, let's table one table, yeah, and multiple chairs, and I group these, and I say this is table group 1-1, so that's the first table in the first row, yeah, and then in the in row one the first table, and we have eight of these groups, yeah, in row one we have eight tables, yeah, so this goes up to this table group, and we don't only have one row but we have 10 of these rows. And now you can do sort of copy paste, yeah, you build this one, yeah, and then you insert it into that tree multiple times, and maybe by some clever editing tool or whatever, yeah, we position all these groups automatically so that they end up at the right place. Yeah, that's probably a practical way to achieve that. But now your problem is, or what means problem, is that this chair here, yeah, appears 900 times, and it's always the same geometry. Yeah, and even if it's only coarsely modeled with subdivision surfaces, as we learned, it's the same model, yeah, at multiple positions in our room. Yeah, only offset in the x coordinate, yeah, by some simple method. And that's wasteful. It's very wasteful. And this is why often we don't use something like this, which would be a tree. Yeah, so this is a tree data structure, but instead we use something like this, which is a graph. And here the idea now is the following. We have, here we see that we have, okay, let's start from this way here. We first start by defining a table group. This is a table and eight chairs. And the table group has the table object as a child. Yeah, this appears once. And the chairs, now all have the same geometry, but we include that same geometry under here, 8 or 10, okay, now here it's 10, sorry, doesn't matter, under 10 different, yeah, instances, and in fact, these nodes here are simple transformations. Yeah, so we just say, okay, this table group has this object here, this is a transformation, and under this transformation we see this geometry. And here we see the same geometry but under a different transformation, yeah? So the first transformation puts the chair here, the second one here, then here, and then on the other side, also the same, yeah? So these are just transformation nodes, and they all see the same geometry, yeah? And so we have now an entire table group. The geometry of that chair, I mean, in fact, that's a vertex buffer object, yeah? It's memory on GPU, yeah? And it's all the data that we need for that chair, yeah? This is only stored once, and we have 10 different transformations, 10 different matrices under which we want to see that chair. And this gives us the table group, and for the table group now, of course, exactly the same is true, yeah? Because now multiple table groups together, yeah, under different transformations form a table row, and multiple of these rows together form the entire Mensa scene. Yeah, so we can nicely group all that, and altogether we only have the table geometry once and the chair geometry once. Yeah, and how often they are shown in that room is just hidden is stored in the hierarchy above. Okay, so that's a scene graph. Yeah, how objects are stored in such a scene. Yeah, and this scene graph normally is then stored on the CPU or in some file, which is then loaded to the CPU. So this is all kept in CPU memory. Yeah? And now to render such a scene, what typically happens is that the scene graph is traversed. Yeah, so we make a traversal, a depth first traversal on that scene graph, and that automatically means, yeah, that, I mean, maybe in algorithms and data structures, you were only doing a depth traversal, on trees, but it exactly works the same way on these directed acyclic graphs, on the scene graphs. And if you do that, then yeah, you arrive at this chair geometry, in that case 800 times or whatever, how many chairs there are, but always on different paths. Yeah, and each of these paths is one particular chair finally in the Mensa. Yeah, so first which row, which table group, and then which chair within that table group. Yeah, and the final position, yeah, you can obtain by gathering all the transformations on the way down there. So first of all, you have a transformation for the current table row, and then a transformation for the table group, and then a transformation for the particular chair. And if we multiply together all these transformations, we have the transformation for that particular chair here. And by modifying a single transformation for a table row, for instance, yeah, we can move entire table rows. Yeah, by just one single transformation. Okay, so to render such a scene, now we have to make such a traversal on the scene hierarchy. Yeah, and always while we go down, accumulate the transformations, and when we arrive here at such a chair, for instance, we know the transformation, and we know that under this transformation we want to have a chair. So in OpenGL, this would mean load the transformation as a uniform, yeah? Set this one single uniform for the transformation, and then say to WebGL, now render this chair using this transformation. And if the chair geometry is already uploaded to GPU memory, yeah, that can happen, so to say, immediately, yeah. Because no geometry has to be uploaded. Just say, okay, render this vertex buffer object with this index buffer object using this transformation, and off it goes. Yeah, and then comes the next chair, new transformation, render it again, render again, render again. So the same vertex buffer is rendered many, many, many times, always with different transformations. Okay, yeah, we will see that again, yeah, so if it was too fast. But that's only one thing. There are many other things that can be done on a scene graph. For instance, animations, simulations on our scenes will happen on that scene graph. Maybe also the subdivision of the objects can happen in the scene graph, yeah, so subdividing the coarse meshes to fine meshes. Also the upload of geometry, so the chair geometry first of all has to be uploaded. Yeah, that also happens in a traversal, so that it sees, okay, this node should be uploaded, the geometry, and so forth. Yeah, so it's many things can happen on scene graphs, and also adding nice effects like shadows, fog, depth of field, and so on. Yeah, all this happens by traversals can be done once we have stored the scene in the form of such a scene graph. And yeah, so this is what I briefly want to look into now, yeah, for the rest of the lecture. Okay, so hierarchical modeling, I mean, essentially I already described most of the ideas, but here now again, for a simple example, yeah, we have a very old-fashioned scene. So this is a chair, and this is a table with a fruit bowl on it. Yeah, and you see we have single, very simple objects that describe that scene. Yeah, here we can see how this might look like. So we have a single group node that groups the entire scene. That's the root node of our hierarchy. Then we have a plane, which is the floor. We have a group with three boxes. That's this chair. And this group is the table, which has the fruit bowl, consisting of a box and two spheres, and the table itself from three boxes, yeah, these three brown boxes. So that would be a very simple hierarchy. In fact, yeah, we can describe that now in file formats, yeah, that not like the OBJ that you've seen before only contains triangles, but this is a little bit, or this is more abstract. In fact, that's a file format VRML, which is well readable, but hardly used anymore, but at least it's readable. And you see, it's a direct translation of that, what we had before. We say, okay, it's a group node, and then all the group children are contained within these brackets, these curly brackets. And then this group node has three children, 1, 2, 3. Yeah, this is the first group, the second, and the plane. And the first group has again three children, these three boxes, and so forth. I mean, yeah, that's very simple. A simple way to model such a scene in that format VRML, which is not of any importance anymore, I think, but well readable. And now one nice thing of that hierarchical modeling is that now we have something like a node that stands for the entire chair. So this chair here is this group, and now we can apply a translation to that group node. And as a result, this entire chair is moving. Yeah, and we can also move the fruit bowl, and we can move the table. Yeah, so we now can control entire groups of objects. Yeah, and we can do that by inserting transformation nodes. So in that example, we insert a node, a transformation node above the group, and with this transformation node, now we can control the transformation. Yeah, for everything underneath. Or sometimes the group node has a transformation attribute, yeah, and then we can change the entire group. That's how it works in SVG. Yeah, and this is now how it looks like. So for instance, here we have such a transformation node, and here this describes the transformation. It's a rotation around the set axis by 45 degrees, and as a result, the chair, yeah, is rotating. Yeah, and we can translate the fruit bowl and so forth. Okay, and now the interesting question, of course, is, yeah, if we now want to render that, yeah, then obviously we have to traverse that tree, yeah, and so that means we start here, then we look at the first child. Oh, here we have a transformation, so we remember that transformation, we continue to that box, and then we render this box under this transformation. Yeah, and we continue with that box. We render it under this, also under this transformation. Then we go back, and obviously now this transformation is done. So somehow we should throw that transformation away and continue with that transformation, and then render everything underneath with this transformation. And if there would be transformations, further transformations here, yeah, we have to gather all these transformations and always keep the transformations from the root to my current node. Yeah, all these transformations are relevant for every object, and to accumulate all these transformations while traversal, we usually apply, or usually something is applied that is called a matrix stack. And here the idea is the following. So we always speak about 4x4 matrices, yeah, using homogeneous coordinates. You know, we can describe rotations and all that stuff with such matrices. And now whenever we do that traversal and we arrive at a transform node, yeah, we remember this transformation by pushing it onto the stack. And when we are done with that node, we make a pull again. And so we've lost that transformation, or we forgot about that one. And pushing now works in the following way. Let's say we have a stack with three matrices, M1, M2, M3, and now we push a new transformation. Yeah, we arrive at a new transformation node. What is then done is that a new transformation is generated, and the up to then topmost matrix of that stack is multiplied with M and becomes the new top of that stack, yeah? And so you see all the previous transformations were remain unchanged, and the new top now is this M3 times the new transformation. So when we arrive at a new child object now, a new chair, we can directly use this transformation to render that. And if we are done with the transformation node, we simply make pop and we are back here again. Yeah, and then for another pop, we are back here and so forth. Yeah, so on top of the stack, we always have the accumulated current transformation. Yeah, very simple means. And yeah, here another example how that looks like. I think I can quickly skip that one. That's probably more interesting. This is how such code would look like. Yeah, we have nodes, a class of nodes. These are nodes in our scene graph. And then we have special nodes that contain transformations. Yeah, this is the transformation of that node. And then all these nodes have a render method. And for the transformation node, this render method takes the current matrix stack. This matrix stack is exactly that matrix stack as you've seen it before. And we simply push the current transformation to the matrix stack and then render all the children. And if we are done, we do a pop on this stack and we are done. Yeah, that's all. We just with push and pop, we keep all the transformations current. And then for the objects, yeah, this would be the chairs, for instance, or the tables in our Mensa scene. Yeah, they also get the render call with the current matrix stack, and they just render then the current object with a modeling matrix taken from the top of the stack. Now, essentially here in OpenGL, that would be the call to GL draw elements. Yeah, but before we have to take that matrix and write it to the uniform matrix for the current object. Yeah. Okay. Good. Now, furthermore, we can use the matrix stack, not the matrix stack, the scene graph to store materials. Up to now, yeah, I only said, okay, we have this Phong lighting model or other lighting models, and they have a number of parameters, diffuse color, and so forth. And in a scene graph, yeah, these material parameters can also be stored as part of nodes. That say, okay, from now on, everything should be reddish diffuse with these parameters and so forth. And it's also that during scene traversal, then it always current material is remembered. Yeah, and then this defines which material is to be used or which shader parameters, or maybe even which shader is to be used for these different objects. Yeah, just by going or just during traversal. Again here, yeah, how this maybe works. So in fact, now we have to, things become yet a little bit more complicated. Up to now, we only had the matrix stack, yeah, that we always had to pass to the render call. Now we need not only the matrix stack, yeah, but also the current material. So we gather that in what could be called a context object, for instance, yeah. So that just tells us the current parameters while traversal. Yeah, and then if we arrive at a material node, for instance, it just resets the current material to M. Yeah, and from then on, this context object is chained. And when then an object is to be rendered, it takes the material from the material context and renders with that material. Yeah, so that would be one possible implementation. To keep track of materials. And you see, yeah, so this is not only a data structure, yeah, but if we have that data structure, yeah, we can generate code that works on that data structure and that, for instance, renders the scene that is described by that data structure. And there's many more stored. Much more information stored than what we've seen now. So there's, for instance, things like light sources, camera positions, textures. We didn't also speak about textures, yeah? So which textures are to be applied, and all that stuff, yeah? That is all stored in that hierarchical data structure. And for rendering, this data structure is traversed, but in fact, there are many more things where this data structure can be traversed. And there's another interesting thing, and these are optimizations that are possible if we have the scene stored in such a scene graph. And in fact, yeah, in the end, this thing can become very big, yeah, and can become a complete framework. The scene graph is at the center, yeah, it's the data structure, but there are many more things around, like rendering optimizations and, yeah, all that subdivision stuff, for instance, can be done by the scene graph and so forth. And there are quite a few scene graphs around. Some of you maybe know the Unity engine, for instance, which is very popular, became very popular in the last years. Yeah, that's one such scene graph, and lots of functionality to work on these scenes. And it can immediately be deployed on mobile phones and on different architectures and so forth. Yeah, it completely abstracts from all these rendering issues. But at the bottom, it still has shaders. Yeah, you still have to define shaders, for instance, or can define shaders and so forth. Yeah, but all the other stuff is done by these large libraries. And yeah, okay, I will come back to that in the end. And just to give a short glimpse, yeah, of what else such a scene graph or, yeah, render engine, in fact, yeah, are the same thing in this moment. Yeah, what they can do are two very simple optimizations, or in fact three. Yeah, so the first one is that on GPUs it is rather expensive to change textures or shaders, and so ideally, what one could do is that you say, or let's say shaders, yeah. Since switching shaders is expensive, yeah, we could sort all our objects of our scene, yeah, and first render all the objects that use shader one, and then render all the objects that use shader two. Yeah, I mean the order in which we render objects doesn't matter. Yeah, so we can do a sorting, and we can sort objects so that we reduce these expensive switches to a minimum. Maybe we have to traverse the tree multiple times, yeah, but that's often worth the trouble. So that's what's called shader sorting, or we can do the same for textures, so the texture switches are minimized. Yeah, so this is something that can be done by that scene graph. And another optimization is the so-called view frustum culling that is very often used. And here the idea is the following. If we are in a complex world, then there will be many objects that I can never see. For instance, because they are behind me. Yeah? That won't contribute to my current image, at least not directly, unless we have reflections or something like that. And we can significantly reduce rendering load by throwing away all these objects as early as possible. So what we could do is that for all our nodes in our hierarchy, we compute the bounds of the geometry in that node. Yeah, we call that a bounding box. It's just the minimum and maximum X, Y, and Z values. Yeah. And this gives us such boxes here. And this is our view frustum. Yeah. And then we can very quickly say, okay, this box does not intersect the view frustum. So all the entire subtree under that node, yeah, can be skipped. When we traverse for rendering, yeah, at that node, we simply stop traversal and skip all the geometry underneath. Yeah? So we don't have to traverse until the end. Maybe sometimes we can find out, okay, we can skip that part, it won't contribute. And by just checking whether that node is in the view frustum, yeah, we have something which is called view frustum culling. And there's another approach which is a little bit more complicated, which is called occlusion culling. This goes one step further. If we have that example, so let's say this is whatever, a yard with a wall around, yeah, and there's a tree behind the wall, and this is my view, Frustum, and I cannot see the tree because this wall is so tall that I cannot see the tree. It would be great to know that, because then I can save all the work for rendering that tree, because it won't contribute, but it's not so simple to find that out, because I need to know that there's a wall in front that occupies everything. This is called occlusion culling. This is more difficult than view frustum culling, but there's a nice optimization on GPUs, on most GPUs. I mean, it's not so well documented, but most probably have it, which is called the hierarchical C buffer. And here the idea is that on these GPUs, we don't only have a normal C buffer like that one here, that for every pixel contains a depth value, but we have hierarchical versions of that. It's like a MIP map. And here, but here now it's not that one pixel here contains four averaged values of here, but instead it always contains the maximum value, so the most distant set value. And there, this goes also up here. And now imagine we want to render a triangle, a single triangle. Yeah. Then we can find one level here where, with only looking at a view set values, we can maybe find out that will definitely be occluded, that triangle. Yeah. We just need to find a node here that covers the entire triangle and that has a set value that is still smaller than the smallest set value of that triangle. It will not always give the correct result, but if it says that will definitely be hidden, it will be hidden. Yeah, we can rely on that and discard that triangle. And in fact, most GPUs do so. Yeah, so they have that hierarchical set buffer, and so they can throw away many triangles early before they come to rasterization using that set buffer. But yeah, so that has requires some extra work, of course, whenever the set value is changed. Yeah, this has to happen in the entire hierarchy, upwards. But as I said, it's at least a variant of that is implemented on GPUs. But what does that mean? It means we can have something like occlusion culling, but it only works if we render our scene from front to back. Yeah. If we take that tree example, if we start first rendering the tree and then render the wall in front, that algorithm cannot work, because it first renders that wonderful tree and then everything is overwritten by the wall. Yeah, that only works if we first render the wall and then it can find out, all these tree triangles, they are all hidden because the hierarchical C buffer has a too small set value already. And so a significant amount of work can be saved by sorting objects when rendering from front to back. Yeah? And this again is something that can be done by the scene graph or by the render engine. When we traverse our hierarchy, we can always decide which of children, if one node traverses its children, we can always change the order. So we can say, okay, I first always traverse to the children that are closest to the current camera. Yeah, so it always first tries to render those nodes that are closer to the camera than those that are further away, and by that this optimization then kick in and generate benefit. So that was just, occlusion culling is a very, there are many, many more complicated methods to do occlusion culling. It was not the purpose to describe that, but just to give you an idea what types of optimizations are possible, and what is all then typically implemented in such a scene graph or in such a render engine. There are one that is more complicated. You see here, these are extra slides for those of you who are interested. You can have a look at that, but I will, for time constraints, also skip it now. And as I already said, there's one render engine that is very popular, that is called Unity, which is very powerful already. And we will look at that render engine And yeah, originally the plan was to do that on Thursday, but we have to skip that because that will be done by Frank Bauer, who is really knows Unity very well, but he has another lecture on Thursday in parallel to this lecture here, so he cannot do it, but he will do it next Monday. Today in a week, yeah, you will get a nice introduction into Unity. You can lean back, yeah, and just see how you can click together scenes and animate all that stuff and write shaders and so forth for that one. And instead, next week, we will start and look into virtual reality. How do these headsets work? What's the technology behind that? And this will be on Thursday. Thank you.